Welcome to Talking About Singing, where we talk about singing. This is a podcast where we discuss and review albums, say what we like, what we didn't like, and just generally nitpick. This week, I'm not even going to introduce my co-hosts. They are so far below our very special guest, David C-Doc Snyder. Welcome to the show, David. How's it going?
Not too bad. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Really doing great.
Dylan, how are
so
you?
So far below, that's high praise.
Well, yeah, these
slightly unnecessary high praise.
No, you got to put these guys in their place. They're really real uppity if you don't just give it to them now and then.
Now I'm excited. We've never interviewed anybody on here before. So,
I'm the first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I am honored.
Yes, as you should be. I'm the highly. I don't know. Anticipated first thing talking about singing.
Yeah, 2019, kicking it off strong.
Yeah, sure.
First, for people that don't know your name right off the top of their head, can you give us kind of a synopsis what you're doing now? We know you from producing Chuck D's last couple albums. What's your cliff notes of your resume there?
That's kind of my current claim to fame. I've been working with Chuck and Public Enemy for about now I got to do math. It's 2019, so it's been 14 years, I guess, I've been working with them.
Wow.
I mean, I was officially longer than that. I've known Chuck for about 20 years now, so I came in right at the end of their the Def Jam era when they went independent, and Chuck was very active on the internet and had a fan site, publicenemy.com, and had a message board on there, if you guys remember message boards. Mm-hmm. So I reached out and became part of a Public Enemy fan community, and I started sending him remixes of stuff I was doing, and he was setting up a digital label at the time called Slam Jams, and that was the kind of the start of our collaboration. And then he knew that I did film and video stuff, which was actually what I kind of grew up doing. Music was just kind of a fun thing to do. I went to film school for a while, and then ran out of money and dropped out. But I was always making, short films and things like that. And around 2005, he finally said, "Hey, you know what? I'm going to make you the guy to do our music videos now." And so since 2005, I've done almost all of the Public Enemy and his solo music videos. So that's it in a nutshell.
Wow.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you started off not even producing. You were just the cinematographer sort of role?
I was producing, but I didn't take it as seriously as the filmmaking. And then the music I was doing ended up taking off before the filmmaking did. It was weird. So, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah, so, that's interesting.
So, initially, did you start off doing, the music side as kind of like a passion thing, like a hobby? Is that, did you see it, I guess, going the direction that it did?
No, that was it. It was, I did music because I like to do music. Mm-hmm. I've been doing rap tracks since I was a kid. And I cut my first demo when I was 16 or 17, and nothing ever happened with it, and so it was just kind of like, all right, that's fun, and I'm gonna do it regardless. We'd make tapes for I'd make tapes for my friends, and we'd do cover art and stuff. We go to Kinko's and Xerox them and things like that, and we make tapes and pass the tapes around to each other, and that was it. It was just kind of because I like doing it. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go to film school. I'm going to become a filmmaker. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And so I was just working odd jobs, and I was trying to make, I continued making short films and just trying to figure it out. And then I got in touch with Chuck online, and he heard some of the remixes, and he said, "Hey, why don't you make an official remix? And so it was like 2002, I did my first official remix for Public Enemy. It was Gotta Give the Peeps What They Need was the song. And I remixed it, and they put it on a promo CD, and it ended up actually getting picked up in a television show. They licensed it for a TV show. So that was like my first paid music situation. And from there, it just I kind of became a music producer, so to speak.
Wow. What show did that end up on?
It was one of those... Oh man, I can't remember what it was called. It was one of those cop fire, you know, rescue shows.
In the early
2000s. It was like a Law and Order ripoff kind of thing. You know, I have to look it up. I don't remember the name of it. It lasted a couple seasons, but it was hilarious because the scene that they used the song in, there were two characters, and the one had a boombox and he was playing the song, and the other guy wanted him to change the song and he said no, so the guy stabbed him. That was the whole set. I thought that was hilarious.
So that was 2002 that happened, right?
Yeah, I did the remix in 2002, and I don't remember if the show came out then or it aired like the next year, but it was right around that time.
Right. So how much of a freak out moment was that for you, that Chuck D kind of scooped you up out of the, I'm sure, swarm of people he's got after him? Was that a pretty big moment for you, or was that kind of what you expected would happen?
No. It was all surreal. I mean, I was a huge Public Enemy fan growing up. They were my favorite group, hands down, and I tried to follow everything they did. And now, so then, you know, fast forward 10 years, 11, 12 years later, and he's calling me on the phone and hey doc, what's happening? It was all weird and really strange. And now he's like, now he's a member of the family. You know, my kids call him Uncle Chuck. So it's, you know,
wow.
It's more commonplace now, but still every once in a while I'll be in a situation where, you know, if I'm at a gig and they're playing or whatever, and then he starts, you know, they start doing Fight the Power, I'm like, oh my God, this is the guy that wrote Fight the Power, you know, and he's like a friend of mine. And so it gets a little surreal, but yeah, at that time though, it was so exciting. It was such a trip because I never thought I'd have a shot like that. So, you know, it was cool. It was very cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That's crazy. That's a crazy story from start to finish, but, we want to not only talk about Chuck D, we have you on the phone here. Let's turn a little bit to your process. What was your kind of initial setup as far as producing goes, as far as kind of the more technical side of it? Dylan's our sound engineer here.
Oh, okay. So I started out making beats on whatever I could. I made pause tapes back in the day. You guys know what those are?
I do not know.
Oh, okay. All right. So pause tapes are, you have a dual cassette deck, and you've got a song on one side that you're, you know, quote unquote sampling, and then you have a blank tape on the other, and you painstakingly play the break part that you want, and you're recording on the other deck, and you just record that section of the tape, and then you pause it. And then you rewind the your song tape back to the beginning of the break, and then you unpause it and then record it again, and you loop it like that by hand. And wow. It's actually very good for learning timing. I actually credit doing music as helping me as an editor, as a video editor, because I think it just really greatly improved my timing and rhythm and things like that, because you deal with that in cutting film and video and stuff. So I started out doing pause tapes, and I was okay at it. I got all right at it. And then I would just, wherever I could get keyboards from that had little samplers, like there was a Casio SK1, I think was the first sampling keyboard I had. And it only had a few minute, you know, seconds. It was like a 3 seconds, I think, of sampling, but we'd make 4-track tapes out of that. And then I got a rack mount sampler and we trigger that. But we were doing everything on 4-track for years, until like 98, 99. And then I got, my first like real PC that had any kind of decent processing power and a CD burner in it. And then I started doing music digitally, and it was really just a combination of different software at the time, like one of the early versions of Cakewalk, Cool Edit. I used Cool Edit a lot. Still do sometimes.
So not to put an age on you or anything here, but you're talking 98, 99 is when you first started doing it on a computer. Is that high school? What age were you then?
Oh no. I'm 40. I'm about to be 45 okay. in a couple weeks here. So I was into my, you know, almost 30s, you know, there, late 20s, okay. early 30s. Late 20s I would have been at that time when I started it. And then I got a hold of Reason. And Reason kind of changed everything, and I still use Reason to this day. So that's my primary, you know, workstation.
That's such a foreign concept for, you know, straight out of college guys like us, not being surrounded by just the technology of it for so long. I mean, Dylan, what was your recent experience like as a starting producer? What's your setup look like straight out of the gate? I mean, I'm sure you had way more resources at your disposal.
Yeah, I just run Ableton right now, Ableton and Pro Tools. But
I've seen Ableton, and I did a remix with one of the other longtime PE producers, Gary G. Wiz. He and I did a remix on one of the Public Enemy albums from a few years back, and we used Ableton. But he used it. I just kind of helped out. So that was my first experience with it. It's kind of similar in setup. To Reason, so I wasn't totally foreign to it, but yeah, it looked interesting. It's an interesting software.
I love it. So coming from, you know, you talked about having the two cassettes going, and you would kind of sample like that. Do you I guess those earlier sampling methods, is that something that you see influencing how you make music now, or do you see that as like a technological gap that you kind of have to change up with, you know, using different softwares and stuff like that?
No, I think it all you build on it, you know. Mm-hmm. You have that experience early on, and like I said, I think it really helped with timing, because back then your timing had to be extremely precise. But I'll tell you one thing that's interesting about it is that you also know where timing, where you can fudge it too. You learn like how you can be off a little bit and give something a little bit of swag or a little bit of a slur to it, you know. And if you're going for a certain sound, a certain feel, I know that Chuck loves that. When we were working on his most recent album, he would tell me, you know, it always doesn't have to be exactly right on, and he likes it when things are a little loose. I did a lot of the scratches on the record, and I'm not a precise DJ at all. In fact, I think I'm actually kind of a half-assed DJ, but he likes that. He liked the sound. He goes, because it's loose, because it's not on time exactly. He said, you know, DJ Lord, that he works with in Public Enemy and Prophets of Rage, is a very precise DJ, you know, and he is. And Lord is a master at that stuff. His timing is impeccable, and he's always right on where he needs to be. But I'm not like that. And so it gives it a different feel. And sometimes sloppy can be a good thing. So coming out of tapes and analog equipment and stuff like that, I think gives me kind of a perspective that I can say, you know what, I can take this. I don't have to quantize this beat. I can take this sample and slide it out just a little bit, or take the snare and make it off just a little bit, just to give it a certain feel, give it a little funk to it.
Is that something that you think how prevalent is that for other artists that you've worked with? Is that sort of common to want it sloppy like that, or do most people want it clean and precise?
It depends. I mean, it's I like to look at tracks as, you know, certain tracks require certain feelings. And I know some artists I work with, one of my partners, Marcus J, he's a real in the pocket guy. So everything's got to be kind of right on. And if I start to get too weird with it, it just throws him all off. So but that's just the way he works. It's not a good or bad thing. And so it's nice to have the flexibility to be able to do that and try things and just see what feels right and what sounds right.
Yeah, that's definitely an aspect of producing I've never really considered, but now I'm gonna listen for that every time I listen to a record from now on.
If you guys are into rap and hip hop at all, or beat making or things like that, you know about J Dilla, you know, guy yeah. Donuts and all that. Yeah. Of course, yeah. he was notorious for that. His stuff is off just a little bit. You know, he would let it. He wouldn't quantize his beats all the time. Sometimes they're rigid, but sometimes he just let stuff slide a little bit. And I think actually he was one of the guys that brought it back into fashion. I know that Questlove from The Roots says that he, for the longest time, he was trying to perfect being in time as much as he could. And then Dilla came along and he said, I had to relearn how to play because I had to throw it all out the window. Cause you know, because Questlove would be working with D'Angelo and D'Angelo would want him to drag it. And he's like, oh, I'm not used to that anymore. You know, cause I'm trying to be precise. I'm trying to be right on beat. So, yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting thing to have in your arsenal. And sometimes you got to get used to it, you know, too, because I know at one point in time, early on, I wanted everything to be quantized and everything had to be right on. Otherwise, it sounded weird to me. But now I've learned to kind of like, you know, let it breathe again sometimes if the track calls for it.
Yeah, I often I'll play to a metronome and I'll play mm-hmm. just little phrases like one bar at a time and then loop that.
Yeah.
But right. like playing it will have that swing to it. And it'll exactly. be off. And sometimes I'll mess up and then go in there and drag it over a little bit. But yeah, like
right.
not right to the grid. Just keep it off a little bit so it has some swing to it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. That's exactly that's and sometimes tracks need that. Sometimes it calls for it.
Do you think that's you said Chuck really likes his stuff just a little bit off? Is that coming out of his, you know, famously booming, powerful voice? Or is that a certain, what sort of feeling does that evoke when it's off a little bit? Or is that kind of universal? Anything could be off a little bit if the artist wants it
well,
that way.
It's, I think it depends. I know he always references coming out of doing stuff by hand, literally. Like, you know, remember when Public Enemy started first making records in the early days, they didn't have the equipment. And so they got into using very primitive samplers. But at the time they were doing tape loops. You know, Public Enemy number one was a tape loop where they would actually cut the 2-inch tape and then stretch it out and run it around a mic stand and all this stuff. So it would loop. But then they would play the drum machine by hand. So, you know, so it wasn't quite on. It wasn't quite right. So it's a little loose. If you go back and listen to that record, it's off a little bit. And so I think he likes the live musician kind of feel of it. So
That's interesting. Yeah, it's definitely something that I'm going to keep a ear out for in the future. Are there more topics like that spring to mind, something that producers need to consider that, I mean, the average Joe Schmo on the street wouldn't even think of being so time consuming or so prevalent in the creation process?
You know what's I obsess over personally is mixing. Mixing drives me crazy sometimes, just because I come from that old, I don't know, how do I want to put it? my favorite kind of mixing was the kind of like the late 80s, early to mid 90s, where everything just kind of sat right where it was supposed to. And I know the style has changed now, because especially in hip hop and rap songs, they tend now to put the vocals up more, and the vocals are more up front. And I like the vocals to just ride right along the top. I don't like them as loud as they prefer. And sometimes I'm told to turn the vocals up, but yeah, mixing for me is just, rarely do I get it right on the first try. Every once in a while I do, but man, it is a process for me. And there have been certain songs that I've just hated it because I could never quite get the mix right. And so that can make or break a song for me personally. I don't know how, you know, your guys' experience with it, or how much attention you pay to it. Do you even mix your songs yourselves? Because I know other people have other people or bring in people to mix their songs.
I mix my own stuff.
Yeah.
I intern at a studio and I can use some of the outboard gear there.
Oh, nice.
For that. And he's got a tape machine, 16 track or 24 track.
Mm-hmm.
But basically we just run digital sounds through that to kind of give it the, I don't know, like little warmth that tape gives sound.
Yeah, that analog kind of, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. More than like, and we could record right to the tape, but he usually just kind of just like reamps it through that.
You mentioned that current hip hop really likes the vocals up front and you like mixing kind of more even throughout. For me, mixing is something I only notice when it's done poorly. I don't know if you listened to Travis Scott's last album, but he had one verse on there that sounded like it was just in a completely different atmosphere than the rest of the track.
It sounded like Nav was recording from like outside of the studio.
Yeah.
Or like the mic was way too high for him.
Was it like in the middle of the verse? I did notice on, I haven't heard Travis's last album yet. I did notice on Pusha T's most recent album, which I really liked. In the middle of one of the verses on Come Back Baby, you can tell it's a different take because like his vocal tone changes like halfway through. So I did notice that, but I don't know if that's necessarily a mixing issue, but yeah, that's interesting. Huh?
It was on Travis Scott's album. It was famously, it was on Yosemite, Nav's verse, like the last 20 seconds of the song. I think it got clowned on so hard, he actually went back and like they remixed it because it was just getting memed on so hard.
Wow. That's strange. I wonder why they would let that fly like that. Interesting.
It almost sounded like it was a mess up. Like they didn't listen to it. And because it sounded like his vocals were just way, way too quiet.
Oh, weird.
Mm-hmm. But it's still out there. You can still hear it.
Yeah, it's interesting that the things that slip through the cracks, you know, that always intrigues me when things come out, because then it's like, you know, I know famously, I know just from experience that, my quality control levels, I try to keep them pretty high so that, you know, things like that don't happen. So, you know, I do the mix and I listen to it 1,000 times and I sign off on it. It goes to mastering and then it comes back and I have to listen to it another 1,000 times just to make sure we got it right. So it's funny when stuff like that happens.
Yeah. We have a kind of an ongoing debate here on the podcast about what is the true album. And I'd love to get your take on it, because nowadays we have the option of releasing an album, somebody big name, Travis Scott, releases an album, pulls it a week later, re-uploads it with, you know, a different mix, a different master, whatever it is. What do you consider, and this will be the end of the debate for the rest of the podcast, what's the true album? Is it that first release or what he wanted it to be?
Man, that is such a loaded question, because I'll give you a film reference. So which is the true version of Star Wars? You know, is it the one that came out in 77 or is it the one that Lucas put out with new effects in 97? You know, man, that's it's tough because you want to say from an artist perspective, it's whichever one the artist signs off on, you know. But at the same time, if they put it out into the world, you know, okay. For example, here's another example, and I never realized this at the time. Chuck told me that when Fear of a Black Planet came out in 1990, it was the version that they put out wasn't the correct mastered version. It was too. It was a couple decibel. It was a decibel quiet. It was something like it was quieter than it was supposed to be. They pressed up the wrong master of the album.
What?
And so when they did the reissue a couple years back, obviously everything was remastered and bumped up louder. So, you know, which one's the correct one? Because he never liked the original, but he likes the reissue because it's louder, like it's supposed to be.
I have always been on the side of the debate that whatever comes out on release date is the true album. But if Chuck D's saying the opposite, I step down. Brendan, you win. You take it.
I mean, is it wrong to say that they're both right? You know.
No, I think that's obviously a middle ground is probably the right answer, but that's one of those philosophical questions you can't help but wonder.
Yeah, I mean, remember when Kanye did the Life of Pablo thing where he kept pulling or re-releasing it or whatever, you know,
right.
every 4 or 5 days? And so,
yeah,
that's...
He just did that with, what was it, Teyana Taylor's album, I think he pulled and... re-uploaded. Yeah, he does that all the time.
Yeah, so that's we've never really been in a situation as music fans where this has happened before, you know. I guess there have been times where there were errors or another thing would be Biz Markie's album, what was the album? I Need a Haircut. And he didn't clear a sample on it, and he got sued. And so they had to withdraw the album and take that song off, and then they reissued it. So, you know, so what's the proper version of the album there? Or Body Count and Cop Killer. Because Warner's issued it with the song Cop Killer. And then, you know, everybody was up in arms about it, and then they withdrew the album and they re-released it without the song. So, but having different versions like this is kind of a whole new thing. I'm wondering if artists just get too excited about putting the album out, and then they jump the gun sometimes, you know?
And then it's so instant now with the internet that...
Right,
you could easily like click on the wrong file and like, oh crap, and then 100 people downloaded it
right.
in an hour, and
right.
it's all over the place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting times now. Interesting times that we're living in.
Yeah, technology really throws a wrench into everything.
It does. It's a blessing and a curse, man. I've always said that because the great thing about it is, especially as artists, is technology has leveled the playing field. And the worst thing about it is that it's leveled the playing field. So, you know, anybody can make a record in their bedroom, you know, or in their basement or in their kitchen or whatever. I don't know if everybody should make a record, but maybe they should. I don't know.
So you see that as kind of a negative thing. You think some, I guess a lot of rappers or producers coming up now, I don't know. I don't want to put any names out there to whatever, but like, do you think there are just too many, I mean, untalented people that are getting too much attention? Do you think that's kind of a sign of current music?
Well, it's hard to say because art is subjective.
Sure.
And I know that I used to be, in my late 20s, early 30s, I was pretty hard-headed about stuff. And so I used to feel that way. But now I'm just kind of the mind that if it has an audience, then it's worthy of something. It's worthy of someone's time. I may not agree with it. I may not enjoy it. I'll skip it, whatever. I try to give everything an even shake, you know, these days, because you never know where you're going to find something that you really dig. And that's kind of the exciting part about it. I do think that, I'll tell you this, I'll tell you where it goes bad is when an artist feels they are entitled because they are an artist. That's when it usually goes bad. Because as an artist, you have to work, and you got to put the work in, you got to put the time in, and you just have to do that and get the experience, and that's going to make you a better artist. But I've known so many rap, I'll say it right now, rappers especially, I hate rappers, man. Rappers are, they can be the worst. They just, I'm a rapper, so I'm in, you know, I'm entitled to this. No, dude, you are not. You know, have you done a show? Have you ever stepped on a stage and rhymed and got booed? You know, have you been through that? You know, so, or just had people be indifferent, turn around and walk to the bar, you know, or nobody shows up and you play the show anyway. I mean, you know, it's there are rites of passage and things like that. And I'm not saying everybody has to do that, but they have to. I think artists should humble themselves until they've earned something. They've earned the right to say something, or they've earned the right to do that, to be like, you know what? I'm pretty dope at what I do. I'm pretty good at what I do. And so, yeah, okay. I'll take this. I'll take that. I'll take the accolades. Sure.
I think there's just a lot more behind being a rapper and artist than people realize.
Oh yeah. And definitely. Sure. Sure.
Yeah. And then they get like, I don't know, cool shoes, and then they can like record a few lines, and then they're like, okay, I'm a rapper. But there's like so much more to it than that.
Yeah. And you know what else cracks me up is that I've worked with guys that are like, okay, well, Tupac would go into the booth and he'd record 30 songs. And Jay-Z goes in the booth and he does one take, spit from memory. It's like, okay, but you're not that guy. You aren't those guys. You can't do that. And you have to do more than one take because your first take sounds like crap. So, you know, so I think that's an entitlement thing. It's they're like, well, I they do it, I can do it, I'll do it. And it's, no, buddy, it's not how that works.
Do you have any like other, I guess, stories about, I guess, diva rappers, like people that are real tough to work with? Could you get on here and say who the toughest person you've worked with is? You don't have to say it if you're not comfortable doing that.
No. Oh, no, no. I'm trying to think of an example.
Yeah.
I know I've worked with. I know I worked with, on the video side, I know I worked with, somebody once that, I showed up and I was ready to go, and it became like a 3-day long thing where we were hardly shooting anything. And it was just kind of like, it was a very bizarre situation where we shot a little bit and then we went to a different location. And we were supposed to shoot some more. And then he had a family situation go on and the shoot all went to hell. And then it was just kind of like me and him sitting around and I was just kind of like talking him through life stuff. And it was strange. It was such a weird, weird shoot and definitely not what I expected. So yeah, that was probably like the weirdest.
Weird.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like you can like put life coach or something on your resume for the next thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I want to, cause I don't want calling me on that, but.
Okay.
So you kind of touched on a couple different topics there with the new wave. One of them is paying your dues, kind of getting out there, doing this thing that you claim to be good at. And then the other one's more of kind of their attitude going into it. What's the, you said humble yourself, but what's the mark of a, of somebody that you can identify talent in when they're just starting out, not a lot of dues paid yet? What's the telltale sign of somebody that you think could be successful?
If they show up and they're, I'll tell you what, if one, I mean, obviously if they have the performance down, or in the case of like, say an MC, so an MC comes in and they have it down and they know what they're doing, or they have a plan, they have some sort of idea. But, I've worked with guys that were, open to ideas and want to learn. You can kind of tell because they want to learn stuff. And they're open to what you have to say, what input you have to give. But they may also say, okay, yeah, that's cool, but I was also kind of thinking this too. And they're just, they kind of want to just take in the whole experience of it. And those are usually the guys that I'm like, you know what? You really want to do the work and you want to make it work for you and you want to make it happen. And you can see it. You can kind of feel it because they bring an energy. They bring an energy to the room and to the session and things like that. And it's like, okay, yeah, let's go. And I know at least that they're going to get something out of it that they're happy with, you know, mm-hmm. beyond anything else. I'm not sure, you know, because it's always a weird thing, man. You never know what's going to happen. I have a group that Chuck, it was actually Chuck's idea, and we're called the Impossibles. And it started off because our first collaboration was we were MCs from different areas, and we would record our vocals wherever we were at, and then we MP3'd them to each other. And then I was producing the project, and so everybody would send their vocals to me, and I'd make the song out of it. And so this was like in 2000 when it was kind of unheard of to do. Now it's pretty commonplace, but like we were one of the early people to do it. And so when Chuck got a new distribution deal for a Slam Jams label, we were going to be the first release on it, and the distribution company in the manufacturing process pressed up the completely wrong album and sent it out to stores.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a nightmare. So it was like our one big debut shot was just completely blown to bits, and it was going to cost them too much to actually recall the album. So it just had to sit out there, and people bought the album, and it was totally the wrong album. They're like, how come it's supposed to have 20 songs and it only has 11 tracks on it? It's like, well, that's not the right CD at all. And
so that's why you are a proponent of what the artist wants is the true album.
Yeah, because that was just a colossal mistake. So yeah, I guess bring that story out, that kind of seals it. But yeah, man, so things like that happen, you know. It's just weird stuff like that happens, and you never know. You could have the most talented dude in the world, but you know, he comes in, he lays down a song, and then he go, you know, there was a MC that Q-Tip was working with around the time of Tribe's second album, around Low End Theory. So it was like 91, and there was this kid that he was working with called Kid Hood, and Kid Hood came in, laid down a verse on the scenario. It was the Scenario remix, and he went home, and like a day later he was shot dead. And Q-Tip was just like, he was going to be the next thing, man, this kid. And you know, just weird stuff happens, you know, life, things happen and get in the way. But back to your original question, if you can tell the people that are ready to work and ready to just put in the time.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a big difference between people being excited to rap and people being excited to get to the studio and work.
Yes, that there is a difference. There's definitely a difference because it's a process, man. You know, recording music, producing music is a process. And you can you go in with a plan. It's filmmaking is the same way. You go in with a plan, but you got to be open to accidents because that can be the best stuff. And you have to have that wiggle room. It's great to try to get exactly what you want, but sometimes you got to leave yourself open to little things.
You mentioned working with the Impossibles and being a part of that. I think the current sort of iteration of that process would be somebody like Brockhampton, mm-hmm. that whole group. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but I think they met on a, what was it, Brendan? Kanye?
It was a Kanye West like fan forum or something like that.
Yeah. What are the challenges of working in kind of a virtual environment with so many people? I mean, are you guys all over the country, different countries? What's the setup there?
Yeah, the original iteration of the group was we had an MC that was out of the UK. And so on the first recording we did. And so, yeah, and we've always been down to collab with guys anywhere in the world. There's a couple of MCs that we've worked with that are they're Canadian originally, but they live in Japan now. They're brothers. And so we've collabed with them. And in the early days, the hardest part was the technology just wasn't quite there yet. So you'd have to send everything in MP3 and because of bandwidth and sending files and things like that. And in fact, I remember the early days, people would even still send me, they record something and then burn it to a CD and mail it to me. So we'd collab like that. But the technology just hadn't quite caught up, but now these days it's kind of the hardest part is if I hear something that I think they should change, then I got to be like, hey, can you send them an email? Hey, can you go back and re-record this part? And it's like, I'm not in the studio anymore. Or I don't, yeah, it'll take me a couple of days to get it done. But, so that can be the goofiest part. But but since the technology is caught up, I think, it's more commonplace now. You know, producers send beats to other guys and they're not even in the studios anymore. And that's interesting, and I think it's good and bad. Of all the music I've done for Chuck, I was only in the studio with him once. So everything else, he just kind of records on his own and then sends it back to me. So, but that's the kind of working relationship we have.
Yeah, I think that's pretty commonplace now, as far as I'm aware anyway. Producers kind of just sending it to him and back and forth completely online. I'm sure that... in one sense, that's a lot easier, but more just kind of annoying to kind of do the nitpicky parts of it.
Yeah, I mean, luckily, okay, for example, like working with Chuck, he'll send me a bunch of takes and then say, okay, here, pull from this. And then on the last album, he was like, hey, I'm going back into the studio. Do you want me to do anything extra? He had heard some things in the temp mixes. He was like, you know what? I want to add something to this or just give me more to work with. Again, it's a different working environment. You know, it's a different way to work. Yeah, you're right. It's not a good or bad thing, or it has good and bad things. I know that when I work with, Marcus, like I mentioned before, he likes to get together to record. So he lives in Dayton, Ohio. I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He drives out 4 hours and we spend a weekend and we record a bunch of stuff. So, he can record something on the fly and send it to me. That's not unheard of. And then he'll say, hey, I'm recording tonight. Can you be around to check the vocals? And I'll say, yeah, I'll check in. And then if he has to redo it, he will. So there are just different ways of working around the limitations.
I think a lot of artists, they like to record alone.
Well, I think it's becoming more of increasingly more of an option because, it might not have been before because you'd have to have an engineer in the studio and so on and so forth. But now if, my studio is in my office and I can just come in here and, okay, I got to bang out some vocals or I got to make a beat real quick. I can just do it. So, but then like, okay, somebody like Chuck, he has a setup where he can do it himself at home, but he prefers to go down the street to the studio in his town, because then he can go in and he knows it's going to sound good, and then his engineer can send it to me and there won't be any issues. So it, but it is definitely, I think, an option that certain artists are becoming more fond of because they can.
So we listen to pretty much everything between the three of us that comes out here. What is, you mentioned Pusha T. What are you kind of staying on top of with hip hop? Do you listen to a lot of new releases, or are you more focused on creating your own sound?
No, you know what? The Pusha T album actually had a very, Pusha T and Daytona and, Kendrick's Damn album actually were big influences on Chuck's record, believe it or not, from me, from a production standpoint. I try to listen to, I just try to listen to whatever's interesting. Earl Sweatshirt's new album is really dope. It's kind of just crazy. And I appreciate the lo-fi-ness kind of grunginess of it. So, but I do, I still listen to a ton of old school records, you know, cause that's just what I grew up on, and I still love it to this day. There's one of the songs on Chuck's album. I remixed his, one of the singles. It's called Tired of 45. And I didn't do the original, and it's more of a modern sounding song. And I heard it and it's cool. It's not my favorite stuff, but it's cool. It works. And I thought, you know what? They're going to be PE fans that hear this and they're going to hate it. And I thought, you know what? Maybe I'll take a stab at remixing it and I'll do like a throwback kind of version of it. And I have been listening to LL's radio album a lot at the time. And so I did a version that tried to sound like that. And Chuck's like, yeah, let put that first on the record. That'll be the first track on the record. I was like, really? I was like, it's just supposed to be a remix. And he's like, no, start the record off with that. Cause he just loved the throwback nature of it. I'm like, okay, cool. So, I take influence anywhere I can from anything. I like to listen to a lot of different things, and I'm not opposed to listening to the newest stuff. I gave every record that Kanye put out this year. Cause I'm not a Kanye fan at all. I like some of his stuff. But I gave every album a shot. I said, because you know, why wouldn't I, you know, I get to give it a chance. And the Pusha album was my favorite of the ones he put out. The Kids See Ghosts was pretty good. There's a couple joints on that I like. I thought his album was garbage.
Yee? You weren't a fan of Yee?
No, not at all. Yeah, I thought it was terrible. So
interesting. Yeah, that was going to be my next question. What's the top and the bottom of your Kanye albums?
Yeah, that one was really disappointing. The Nas one, I got to go back and listen to again because I listened to it and it was kind of there, but nothing really stood out to me. So I kind of I got to go back and I listened to the Nas album. Like, you know what? I'm going to put Push's album back on because I'd rather listen to that right now.
Yeah. I think a lot of people had the same thought.
Yeah. It was just kind of like, and it was a shame too, because I like Nas. I don't worship at the altar of Illmatic like some people do. I do think it's his best album. But I don't think it's the greatest rap album of all time, but that's me, you know, that's my, you know, personal opinion. But I think he works best when he's brief like that. And Illmatic is a 10 track album with an intro. So it's actually 9 songs. And so I was like, okay, he's getting Kanye. They're doing 7 tracks. The album cover's dope. This could really be something. And then it was just kind of there. And I was like, okay, you know, maybe I'm missing something. So again, I got to go back and listen to it and give it another shot. But, you know, I thought Push's album was really dope. And I'm glad they put that one out first because That was definitely the strongest one to lead with.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was pretty well liked between the three of us. I can't remember exactly. Yeah. Nas had a line on that album, something to the statement of Nas is nothing without a producer behind him. Nas really credits the production for getting him where he is today. How do you see that as a producer? Do you see yourself as having the power to take an okay rapper and make them great? Or kind of what is your role in boosting someone? Could you take a mediocre rapper and make them great? Or does that rapper need to stand on their own even before you come in?
It's easier if they can stand on their own. I don't think I can make a mediocre rapper great. I might be able to give them a great song. As a producer, your role is to make the song sound as the best possible way it can. So if I get somebody and I can recognize their strengths and their weaknesses and have them play to their strengths and then craft a song around that, we could probably make a great song. You might be able to make a couple great songs. If you're lucky, if you're in the pocket, you might be able to make a great album out of it. But I don't think you can solely elevate, someone's entire career from that. Maybe you can, it'd be really tough, but I think Nas, I would agree with his statement just because of some of the albums he's put out over the years. And I know that there was a great article somewhere, and I can't remember, it might have actually been Questlove that wrote it. But I don't know if that's correct. But anyway, a few years back, and it was saying how Nas changed after it was the Source Awards or something like that, when Biggie got all the acclaim, when Ready to Die kind of won the awards and Illmatic didn't. And he said you could see in Nas's face there was a fundamental shift in his thinking. And that he's like, you know what, I got to do poppier songs, I guess. And not be so worried about the ruggedness of the streets. I mean, his first album, Illmatic, is a, you know, he had the cream of the hip hop production crop there, man, you know? So, you know, Premier, Large Professor, LES, Pete Rock, Q-Tip. I mean, you know, he went for the hip hop fans go to guys to produce that record. And then after that, it was like Trackmasters and, okay, these guys are trying to make hit records. So there was that fundamental shift. So, and for Nas, it didn't always work. You know, he would try to do those records and they didn't always fly. So I could see why he would say that. I think he's still searching, you know. I don't think he's quite figured it out yet, but music is funny like that, man. It really is.
Yeah, we see a lot of artists that they get such huge acclaim, such a status. How do you follow that up? I mean, Chuck D in particular, huge status, Public Enemy, household name. How do you follow that up afterwards? And it's great to talk to somebody like you who's kind of in that process with him, still bringing out his strengths and, yeah, being involved in that process.
You know what? The thing early on working with Chuck that I had to get over, I had to get past, was because the temptation was there. The temptation was always there to, let's make another It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. You can't. You can't make another It Takes a Nation. Chuck is older now. It's 30 years later. He's not going to sound like that. He doesn't sound like that. He's not trying to sound like that. And the best piece of advice he gave me was, don't try to make one record sound the same to the next. And, you know, do what you do best, and you get your lane and you get the things that work and you figure out what doesn't work, but you also got to try to kind of stretch it. When we were working on the last Public Enemy album, from 2017, it's called Nothing Is Quick in the Desert. He said, everybody's starting to speed up beats again. Let's go slower. Let's go the opposite. Let's slow everything down. And so that's what we tried to do. And So I like the fact that he wants to take chances and try some things and always try to mix it up a bit. So that's encouraging for me.
Yeah, and he put that album out just on like YouTube. He didn't even try to promote it or sell it really, did he?
That's complicated. It it was dropped as a it came out as a Bandcamp release for a week. And a free release for the fans. And then we pulled it, and we had every intention of releasing it in a traditional manner. You know, we were getting ready to do vinyl CDs, and we were even going to do cassettes. And then there was a lawsuit, and so that stopped everything. And so everything kind of came crashing to a halt. So it wasn't Chuck's fault. It was a bad previous business situation, but the album got swept up into it. And so we're just waiting now to hopefully get everything resolved, and then we're going to put the album out. So that's the idea. He's even talking about reworking some of the there you go. He's even talking about reworking some of the tracks. So which is the official version, you know?
Right. Well, we don't want to take up too much more of your time here. We try to shoot for about an hour, but you did mention earlier what you don't consider the best hip hop album of all time. Can we get your opinion dealing with superlatives here? Best hip hop album of all time?
I never try to say what the best is, but I'll tell you what my favorite is.
All right.
Because again, it's subjective, and I've tried to get away from saying that stuff. But my favorite album, probably still to this day, is Public Enemy's Fear of a Black Planet. And the reason why is it's so dense and so complicated that even now, almost 30 years later, anytime I listen to it, I hear something different. I hear something that I didn't hear before. Whether it's I pick up on a line or something, or a sound in the background of the mix, it truly is an amazing album. And you know, and the conversations that I've been fortunate enough to have with Chuck about that album and how they put it together, it's just jaw dropping the amount of work that went into creating that album. And it still holds up to this day for me anyway. So it's still my favorite.
All right. There you have it. Listeners at home, best album of all time. He won't say it, but we will.
Now, can you guys, do you guys, I'm curious about your opinion,
Favorite. Oh, I'm a big Eminem guy. Brendan hates me for it, but I got to say Marshall Mathers LP. That's probably my favorite. I'll say favorite too. Best okay. Somewhere in there.
I know a lot of people that love that record. I think it's too long, but that's just me.
Yeah, too much D12 on there. If he could have kicked D12 off a little bit, would have been better.
I remember listening to it for the first time. I was in the car driving somewhere, and I was like, wow, why isn't this album over yet? And it kept going and going and going. I mean, it was a long... But then I also got to say, back at the time when that album came out, that was kind of the MO for putting out albums on major labels. It was like, pack it full of songs, man. Fill up the entire 78 minutes of the CD or whatever the hell, So that was just kind of the thing back then.
You get a little bit more of that. You're having albums that are like Sway Lee or what was it? Ray Shremmer, they dropped it like a triple album, and you have like Migos dropping like 20 some tracks and Drake doing the same. You'll either have one of those extremes or you'll have, the Pusha T 7-track albums. You get it seems like it's one or the other.
You know what really, and just to follow that up with is what bothers the hell out of me about that is that people don't know what the terms mean anymore. You can have a 7-track album. I remember when Push's album dropped, people were like, this is like an EP. I'm like, no, an EP is 4 songs that you put on a 45. That's what an EP is. That's what it is. It's not a single. It's not an album. But it's like, if it's 7 songs and he calls it an album, it's an album, man. That's what it is. So, and then other guys are like dropping, this is my new EP and it's 10 songs. I'm like, no, what the hell are you talking about? That's an album. You know, Isaac Hayes's Hot Buttered Soul is 4 songs. Now, granted, you know, they're 10-minute songs, but still, it's 4 songs and it's an album. So, you know, people just, I don't know, the terminology and the definitions have gotten out of hand of what is what. Like, and it drives me nuts, you know. It's not real hip hop. Yeah, what are you talking about? You know, it's like, look, it's either a rap record or it's not. Or it's a pop record. Or they're like, oh, I hate Drake because he's not doing real hip hop. Drake's a pop artist. Let him be a pop artist. You know, you don't have to listen to him if you don't want to hear it. So, but yeah, you know, they still have that. They're putting out 30 songs or whatever, triple albums and shit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. But it is, you know, artist prerogative, right?
What's your favorite record, though, Brendan? He said why I was wrong.
That's not why you're wrong, man.
Is the best album of all time.
Hip-hop.
Hip-hop, best hip-hop album. Aquemini?
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. That's a good choice.
Dylan, what's your favorite?
What's your favorite album of all time, then?
That would be Blonde, Frank Ocean.
Oh, Wow. Interesting.
Definitely. It's perfect.
What did you think about the other one?
What was the
one he dropped the day before?
Oh, that was like to get out of his deal with Def Jam, Endless. Like that.
It was good, right?
It was good. It wasn't as, I don't know. It wasn't trying to be as grandiose. It wasn't trying to be as big, but it's got some real good songs on it.
That's what I thought too, and I thought it got overshadowed by Blonde, and I was like, wow, that's a shame because there's some really good stuff on this record.
I think that's another thing. People didn't know how to interpret that because when that came out, it was a, you know, air quotes, visual album, and it was only released through Apple Music, so nobody was like, they're like, what is it? And then like Blonde came out, they're like,
oh yeah, here's the album.
Wayside.
Yeah. I know he released like limited edition versions of all that stuff. I wish he'd re-release it because I'd like to actually pick those up.
Yeah,
but and not have to pay $300 for them.
Yeah, I spent money out the ass to get Endless. I've got a record player. I bought the record. And I spent like, man, that had to be like $100 on like a double album.
Yeah, Endless. That's right. That's what it was called. Yeah. Wow.
Dang.
Well, I salute you for your for doing that, sir.
For my economic irresponsibility.
Hey man, when it's music, sometimes you gotta do that.
Yeah.
Dylan, what do you got? Favorite hip hop record of all time?
Mine changes daily.
Sure.
But right now I would have to say ASAP Rocky is Testing.
I haven't heard that.
I like that a lot. It's so good.
Wow.
That is a surprise to us, and we're friends over here. Huh? Came out of nowhere.
Yeah, I just decided that right now. That's my favorite.
I thought you were going, I definitely thought you were going Wiz Khalifa, Kush, and OJ.
That's a good one, too. I mean, that's old. You got to keep up.
It's a mixtape.
And it's mixtape. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Now, can I ask real quick what you guys think about the mixtape? Like, you know, moniker, because I think really mixtapes just started so people could sample whatever the hell they want and not get sued for it.
Yeah,
is the distinction between like an album and a mixtape is mixtapes are like released for free to specifically get around the like the sampling stuff.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. I mean, a mixtape back in the day used to be it was a collection of songs that were already out.
Sure.
So.
Sure.
You know, that we put out on, that we would make tapes, you know, actual tapes. Chuck had a great line on one of the songs. It's something about a mixtape, but it's not mixed and it's not tape or something like that. I forget what that was, but I know they're mixtapes. I have a Wiz mixtape, that he put out when he was still here in Pittsburgh. Welcome to Pistolvania, I think it is.
Deep, you know, cut. I think that's a deep cut from Wiz.
Yeah, cool. I mean, it's like, you know, burned and printed on a printer and stuff, you know, that kind of thing. So
nice.
early Rostrum Records days or whatever it was.
Right.
You know, Pittsburgh's own.
Pittsburgh got to represent.
Yeah.
All right.
Anything else you want to shout out, promote?
Just the main thing right now is Chuck's album, and we're gonna get the you can get it on CD now. We got vinyl and cassettes coming for any of the tape heads. So yeah, that's the main thing. I just wanna trying to get the word out. I know we don't have a big advertising budget behind it, so a lot of people didn't even know it was out. So it's just kind of like spreading the word of mouth to let people know Chuck D's got a new album. It's called Celebration of Ignorance. And it's on Bandcamp and all the digital outlets, and it's out there. And you know, hope people dig it. It's been, you know, the fans have been giving it some pretty positive reviews. So
yeah, we'll definitely link it in the description, all that fun stuff. But definitely great. Check it out.
Fantastic! Thanks, guys. Right. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for talking to us here. We really appreciate it. I'm sure we'll be talking about this conversation off mic here for a while. So it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
You too.
Take care. See you.